This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm talking to Nina Sankovich. She's the author of Tolstoy and the Purple Chair, My Year of Magical Reading. Hi, Nina. How are you?
Hi, David. How are you?
It's good to talk to you. So this book, for those who are listening and who are not familiar with it, is a story about a period of time in your life when your sister had died. And you responded to that. I mean, it was a very emotional and difficult period for you. And you committed to reading a book every day for a year, which is a pretty amazing thing to have done. So maybe you could talk a little bit about, you know, the story of how that came to be.
Okay, well, my sister died after a very brief illness. And she was 46 years old when she died. And the whole experience was horrible for my family, of course, of losing her when she was so young and so quickly. And I felt responsible after she died for everybody in my family, for taking care of them and their sorrow, and for making them feel that things would get better, even though I wasn't at all sure myself how they could get better. And I kind of put myself on this treadmill of speed that I was going to do everything, not only to take care of the family, but I had this sort of wacky idea. I was going to live double. I was going to live for my sister and for myself. I was going to do everything Anne-Marie might have wanted to do, and I was going to do what I had to do. And it was a crazy idea, and it just made me... As I say, just I was on a treadmill going faster and faster. I became soccer coach of my youngest kid's team, and I did volunteer work for the PTA, and I drove into the city to see my parents a lot, and I tried to be there for my sister. And then as my own 46th birthday approached, I started to feel very scared that I really was not handling things the way that I should. I became very worried that I was not living, having been given life while my sister's life had been taken from her, I wasn't living a life that was worth living. I was being crazy. So I had an idea that a lot of people would probably think was crazy and obsessive, but I kept coming back to the fact that something that Anne-Marie and I really, really shared was our love of books. And I thought, I'm going to... For 1 year, I'm going to do what I want to do, and it's something that I would have shared with her, all of these books. I'm going to read a book a day, and to really make it sort of a discipline to learn from, I was going to write about every book I read. So not only was I going to read a book a day, I was going to write about it. And I saw this on a lot of different levels. I saw this as being a good idea. It was a good idea for me to step back from everything else I'd been doing and focus on one thing. It was a good idea for me to focus on something I liked to do. And I'd always turned to books my whole life for answers when I had problems or unhappiness. And I thought, this time I'm turning to books again, you know, for escape. But there's a wonderful quote that I have in my book from Cyril Connolly, that books are not an escape from life, but into life. Because I really feel that in books, life is presented, you know, in all of its different facets, and that I would learn from reading the lessons in these books, and I would find comfort where comfort could be offered, and answers where answers could be found. And I would find escape. I would find, you know, way out of this crazy place I found myself in, and back to the person that I'd been when I still had hope about tomorrow and really dreams for my future. I wanted to go back to that, and I wanted an answer to the sorrow. Not a solution, but an answer, if you understand there's a difference.
Yeah. Yeah. So do you feel like you, when you sort of talk about being crazy and this desire to participate and do so many things, and then on the other, it's almost like the other end of the spectrum is to get lost in reading and words. Those are kind of the two almost different ends of the spectrum as a way for you to create a balance.
Yes, I needed to focus. I was running so many different directions. I wasn't really focusing, and I realized I was running away from guilt that I was still alive, running away from fear that I was going to die soon also. fear that I couldn't take care of my family. So I needed to stop running away and kind of face these issues head on. And I really felt like there was no better sort of medium for doing that than through books.
Right. And of course, you have four children of your own. You have family, you know, you have all kinds of obligations. Right. So for you to be able to read a book a day and write about it and also keep to the kind of rigidity of that schedule, you had to really carve out time. And you know, it's just, you know, everybody I think who reads this will think, gee, how could you possibly do that every day? There's, you know, I think about days when things fall apart and, you know, nothing right. works. And how do you read a book? And then how do you write about it? Did you write about it? You didn't have to write about it within the day that you read it, though.
No, usually the schedule that I followed really was that I would write in the morning. So I would sleep on, you know, read the book, sleep on it, and the next morning write my review. And I had this whole grand plan. I was not working at the time. I had stopped working a few years before, and I'd been thinking about going back to work, and there was definitely, you know, an impulse within the family, you know, Nina, you might need to go back to work. But we decided that for 1 year we would really allow me to have this year of reading. And I had this plan, you know, the kids get on the bus and I have 6 hours. So a couple hours to write the review, 4 hours to read the book. And by the time they come home, after school starts, I would be ready to go. And so I chose, I planned on really sticking to books between 200 and 300 pages. But my plan, my grand plan, you know, it fell apart pretty early on because things happen. As you said, things fall apart, kids get sick, cars break down, all kinds of things happen. And, you know, there were days when I would read late into the night so that I could finish that book. But what I found really within the first couple months was that there was so much time for reading that I had never used before, that everybody really has. You know, you can read while you're eating breakfast. You can read while you're waiting for the kids to come, you know, out of whatever place it is you're picking them up. You can read while the water is boiling for the pasta. You can read while the pizza delivery man is making his way to your house. We definitely ate more takeout and delivery than we had before, but my whole family was behind me and they also were very willing to help with things like laundry and cleaning. I set up a schedule. People adhered to it because I had support. If I couldn't have done it without the family saying, you know, go ahead and do it, although they all thought it was crazy, they still supported me. So what I think has been interesting for me in talking to people about this is how I'll say, you know, well, maybe, you know, if you don't go on Facebook 5 times a day, you'd have more time for reading. And everyone says, yeah, gosh, that's so true. And since my year of reading has ended, now it's been over a year and a half, I do find that I let other things creep back in. At first, I was great. I was still reading as much. And then, you know, you do find yourself checking Facebook or checking email messages or just kind of gazing off to the distance, thinking about where you're going to cook for dinner. And I'm not reading, you know, obviously at the pace I was before. But on the other hand, books are always in my bag. I always have something with me to read because I don't want to lose too much that space that I'd carved out for myself for reading.
Right, and I think, I don't want to talk about the mechanics of it too much, but I think the lesson for people thinking about the power and importance of writing and reading that you can gain from reading your book is that it should be integral. I mean, it's not even a should be, as like a school teacher might say, you know, you should read more, it's better for you.
Right.
I mean, the book itself is explores how books make a difference in your daily life. I mean, clearly, the story that you're telling is about the reading, but it's really more about your life. And so you take, you know, the book itself, not so much the books that you read, but the book that you've written is weaving together the books that you read with your past and how you've, in a kind of, the book, your book is a integration of your experiences in your life, trying to, you know, you talk about your sister, you talk about your parents, and I think it really works well. But I think, you know, if there's a takeaway for people who are readers who feel like they don't read enough, it's not that you have to read every day, but it's that you have to make the effort. You know, even for me, when I started doing these interviews, the reason that I started was that I felt I needed to discipline myself to read at least a book a week, you know. And so, you know, I don't, you know, now I either read a book a week, sometimes I'll read three, sometimes I'll read none. But the idea is, you know, I realized that other things had pushed books farther down, you know, and, you know, I sort of share memories of when I was young. You know, I would read under the covers. Mm-hmm. I brought a book with me wherever I went.
Right.
You know, read in the car, even though it makes you sick.
Right.
There's a friend of mine has called it interstitial reading. It's reading in these moments in between. And I, you know, of course, it's easier in a way with an electronic device because you can put the phone in your pocket.
Right.
Carrying a book around, you know, people would always make fun of you if you carried a book around when you were a kid. Oh, you're a bookworm.
Right.
You know, you're reading at the table and all that stuff. Which obviously you were.
Yeah. And I was allowing at least one night a week we would have, I would allow the boys to bring their books to dinner, and then everyone was happy. And that, you know, what you're saying, what reminds me here is that the reading was never a chore. The other stuff was a chore, you know, getting the laundry done and, you know, cooking dinner, all that was a chore. But the reading, even when I was reading a book a day, it was never a chore. It was such a joy. And, you know, even now I'll find myself starting to read a book, and I know I have other things too, but there's nothing that is so much fun as sitting there reading my book. And
well, it gives you a chance. I mean, I know it's been written about many times, but it transports you into either it can be another place or a transformational experience which you can share. And, you know, I guess I wanted to ask you, I mean, you read, okay, so it was 365 books. In Tolstoy and the Purple Cherry, you wrote about maybe, I'm thinking 50 or 60 of them of come up.
Right.
Maybe a little bit more.
And I actually bring up books from childhood. Like I talk about Harriet the Spy and My Mother's Most Beautiful Woman in the World was the first book I ever stole.
Which you still have?
Yeah.
Yes. you admitted it in the book, too.
Yeah.
Somebody could come after you for that.
I think I paid philosophy. I really do.
I know. I think I have a book that I that has a library on it, and I never can remember how I got it. You know, is that a book that I took home, forgot, lost? Did you know? Obviously, would have paid for, or what? You know, how did I get that book?
Yeah, that's funny.
But you know, books, I think that it's something common to many readers that you know your experience here is that certain books become touchstones for experiences.
You can't let go of them. You just and as much as I do like my e-reader, and it's useful for many things, I will never be able to let go of a physical book.
Now, do you feel sentimentally attached to specific books? Like, you'll never get rid of those, because you talk about that, too, that you've got all these books. You have all kinds of other things from when you were growing up, too.
Yeah.
So you obviously
sentimentality a little bit.
So of the 365, do you kind of feel like there were favorites that, not necessarily books that were, that you wove into the fabric of this book, but books that stand out as things that were really great discoveries of writers you'd never heard of before?
Well, I did discover a lot of writers I'd never heard of, because one of my rules was that I had to read all new books. Not necessarily new authors, but all books I had not
books
read
Books you had
before.
Never read before.
Books so I'd never read
no,
before.
Not one was rereading.
Right. I did turn to some of my favorite authors, but I'm the kind of person, if I like an author, I read everything. So there were a number of favorite authors I couldn't read because I'd read everything. So I had to find new people. And our local library here, the Westport Public Library, they do a great job of buying a lot of books from smaller presses and a lot of translations. So I was able to read books. There was one by a Portuguese writer named José Eduardo Agualusa, The Book of Chameleons. Not a big book. It was maybe 200 or so pages. Such a great book. And it made such an impact on me. It's about a man who gives memories to people who are trying to rewrite their lives. And but then along comes someone whose memories are so horrible, really, that you cannot cover those up by having a new persona put over that. And it was, what was interesting was that even though the book started out, it seemed to be a book about how you can get rid of memories and replace them with new ones, the actual lesson at the end was that, no, your memories are your memories, for good or for bad, for whatever, but they are part of who you are. And what so many books did for me the year that I was reading was bring back memories of my sister to me and make me realize I would always have those. Even with my sister gone and no new memories to come, I would always have all of our memories together. And I really saw that as a theme in so many of the great books that I read, that memory is what we rely on.
Right. Well, in fact, stories are tellings.
Right.
You know, the reason that tellings are so powerful. You know, if we go back to what was prior to writing, it was oral history, the stories.
Right, right.
And in fact, the first story is probably a creation story. It's how did we get here? Who are we? Why are we here? And I think probably in the end, that's what writing is about. That's what all literature is about, is trying to answer those questions and then pass those memories on so that theoretically, and I don't think it's ridiculous to say this, that, you know, the memories of the earliest writers are what we know.
Right.
That's all we know.
That's all
it's
we
there,
know.
You know,
yeah.
But they've left that to us.
Right.
So one of the great things about art and writing is that it lives, well, it doesn't live forever. It lives as long as the words are available on some medium, paper or otherwise.
Right.
And of course, maybe paper is not going to last forever.
Yeah.
But from the point of view of our culture, it is, and of our kind of mass psyche, if you want to look at it that way, it's the only way we can pass things on,
right,
other than our own experiences.
Right.
I mean, the memories you have are yours, and it's hard to share them in any other way,
yeah.
You know, when you
yeah.
think about that.
No, it's true.
So.
The next sort of avenue that I'm exploring and thinking about writing about is how letters are also recording of memories. They're very intimate, personal ones, and we are turning into a culture that does not use letters at all. We use emails a lot, and I get lots of texts from my kids, but I've never gotten a letter from my kids. I'll get a birthday card, but they, you know, that is a loss. And they really haven't gotten a letter from me either. I'm not blaming, I haven't really written to them. So
that's true, we don't write letters.
Yeah.
I mean, that, although I think that it's fair to say that the impulse that email represents is the same impulse that writing
right.
letters represents. And I feel like we have to be careful always to not think that the prior form was always better.
Right.
You know, handwriting in some ways is more personal than typing. There's no question about
right.
that. And a personal contact is more has more meaning than a telephone call. So I think it's probably true that a written letter, written by hand, signed in ink, has more weight than an email.
Yeah. It
takes longer to do. It requires
right.
more effort.
It shows a commitment.
Yes.
Right.
But it doesn't, I don't think it necessarily means the loss of letter writing means the a loss of culture.
Right.
What
oh,
it just
okay.
means
that's
a difference.
What you're right.
Because you're able to write more. I mean, the beauty
right.
of email, and of course this has another double-edged component, and that is it's so much easier to write. People can write almost anything.
Right.
So they say almost anything.
Right.
And the same thing is true of writing. If you sort of think about people who wrote in longhand, there was a pretty big effort and commitment there, whereas people who typed, even
right.
on a typewriter,
right.
it was a lot easier. They could type more. And then people who write on a computer can do even more.
Right.
So, but then the question is, you know, is it better? Is the writing better because you write in longhand? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't, and maybe because if your hand gets tired, you don't write as much as you would have, whereas you might
right.
write something longer in email.
Or maybe somebody can't read your handwriting.
Right.
And so when they go to transcribe
the whole history's
it,
lost.
Nobody knows.
Yeah.
I, you know, speaking of letters, I found when my father died recently, I found some letters in a file folder that had been written to my grandfather.
Oh my gosh.
And I can't read them. I don't know who the person who wrote it was
right.
because you can't read the handwriting.
Right. Well, that turn of the century handwriting was very kind of
yeah.
loopy. And, I mean, I don't know when it was, but I have letters that are from that time and they're so difficult
really
to read.
Really hard to read. It takes somebody who's familiar with it.
Yeah.
Well, let's go back
yeah.
to your book.
Okay.
Just, you know, because it's actually, I thought it was a wonderful book. And I loved the way that you about the, not, it wasn't just about the year of reading,
right,
even though that's what it says it is on the cover. It's really about your coming to grips with the, you know, with the death of your sister. And there was a great scene, I think, when you're talking about Long Island, where you used to spend time with her. I think she had a, they lived in Long Island. And I should point, I guess I should say, just to place this for people who are listening, you live in Connecticut, suburban Connecticut. Your parents live in New York now, although you grew up in Chicago, and your sister lived in Long Island. So you were all fairly close geographically at the time this took place. So you went into New York a lot when she was sick, and then, but you spent a lot of time with her in her house in Long Island.
Right.
So there was a scene, I think, kind of at, near the end of the book when you go back to Long Island. Was it after, was it a year after she had died? And I think you sort of, you kind of evoke that feeling that she was still there. And
I still feel that every, since it's, I still feel that every time we go to that house, it's so strange because it's, I just picture her so clearly coming across the lawn to welcome us out of the car, you know, and at the time it was, it made me very sad. Now when I go there and I can picture, I'm still sad, but I'm also so grateful to be able to still remember that.
Right. Well, maybe, and do you feel like the writing of the book strengthens your memories?
And that brought new memories.
Brings
yeah,
them forward.
Absolutely. And talking things, you know, with my parents about certain things that had happened. Writing the book was good for, I really think, for my whole family. We all talked, you know, a lot about what I was doing and our memories of a family, trips that we had taken together.
And did your family members help remind you of things that happened? Or was it, are these
all
really?
It, what was funny is that my other sister, Natasha, she would say, well, I don't remember it that way. And then, you know, my mother, well, I remember it this way. And you, and that's why, you know, it's really, it's a memoir is how, is what it is. And not a history, because people remember things in all different, in all different ways.
Well, but, and of course, it's probably, I'm sure anybody who has read memoir or story or history that they were part of has a question about, it may not be the veracity, but the total accuracy. You know, you can, of literal events, just because what you're saying is so true that, you know, you could have 10 people participating in the same event, they're all going to have a different version of it.
Right.
And
or
so,
experience of it. Like, I was just talking to my sister about a different trip where we had a banana split in the south of France, and I hated it because they used, like, a sour cream, whipped cream on the top of it, and she remembered it completely differently, like, oh no, that was the best ice cream. So it was just very funny to realize even those kinds of things are very different in particular.
So, and did your family members, have they read the book, and
what did they they liked it, they,
did it help them too?
I think so, certainly my parents, it's, the book is very much about my sister, and so I think, and they both, both my parents really feel that I captured her. She was a very intelligent, complex, could be very demanding, but a completely generous and loving person. And I hope that, and I know that comes across in the book, who she was.
No, I think you painted a pretty strong portrait of her as a person. I mean, of your whole family. There's stuff in there about your father and your mother and them, they're immigrants, and you're a you're all children of immigrants, so that's also a part of your story. But you know, it's, and I think they're the I think what the good, a good book, a good piece of literature, a good work of art will overcome or will transform experience, and that I think is really what you did. You know, you took an experience and turned it into something else, and I think that's an amazing thing to have done.
Thank you.
So, well, I want to thank you for spending some time talking to me today.
Thank you, David.
We could keep going.
So much.
I also want to mention that you still have your website, which is called readallday.org.
Right.
And I should also point out that I've sent you some books for that you've read, and
And the Sunfield was one of my most favorite books of the year too.
So I'm glad I was able to participate in your magical year of reading.
Yeah. Don't taping?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, thanks so much. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. I've been talking to Nina Sankovich, who's the author of Tolstoy and the Purple Chair, My Year of Magical Reading. Thanks.